Okay, hello everyone, thanks for coming. This is a very special occasion, presentation of the Rima Lupus Award. It's really the highest award that there is in psychiatric epidemiology, and it goes back to 1972, and you would recognize many of the names who received this award. It was set up by Rima Lupus's husband, Milton Terrace, when Rima Lupus died in 1971. And it's worth noting that she was really one of the foundational figures in psychiatric epidemiology, especially in child mental health. And she was one of the first people to identify the problems of methods of measuring normal and abnormal behavior that, you know, have like been with us ever since.
It's hard to hear over here.
Oh, okay. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, there you go.
Oh, it's me. Okay, sorry. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Is this better? Okay. I can't get closer than that. Okay. I'm afraid. So, anyway. So. She was also a great advocate of for disadvantaged people, for national health care. She was part of the medical care section of the APHA, along with Milton Terrace. And, you know, that was the section that that were the advocates for health care legislation during those times. And she had a son with schizophrenia, and that was also part of what drew her to psychiatric epidemiology, and they both did work together on that. So when she died, Milt Terrace, who of course is a legendary figure in public health himself, set up this award, and it's a joint award of the mental health section, the epidemiology section, and the applied statistics section. And in different years, if you were to look over the people that have received it, people have come from all these different sections. So what better person could we have to receive the award today than someone who's dedicated his life to understanding the needs of people who are disadvantaged, to trying to understand how to improve conditions of people in those situations, and who's achieved one of the highest levels of scholarship. We would say, the committee that elected him unanimously would say, the highest level of scholarship in psychiatric epidemiology. So that's William Vega. He has many appointments. One is provost professor at University of Southern California, and the other of many is executive director of the Edward Roybal Institute on Aging. And then he has many other appointments in different departments in University of Southern California. He's, as we were just talking before, he's sort of gone through the life course as he's gone through his life course, studied adolescents, perinatal period, and then now he's studying aging. So he's done a lot of work of different parts of the life, of course. But all of this work has been, as I understand it, focused on multicultural epidemiologic and services research, and especially, though not only, on Latinos and mental health and substance use. And in this area, he's really set the agenda for work, and he's one of the most highly cited social scientists in the world. And he's approached it from all angles. He's been, you can see from the title, from the angle of migration, intergenerational effects, also access to care, stigma, policy implications. All of this has been involved. And but what really, I think what really grabbed me when we were deciding that he should be the person to receive the award is the kind of the depth and creativity that you see in his work. And I We'll just mention two things that I read that were that I thought were profound. One was in Epidemiologic Reviews. It was a review of disparities in health for Latino populations. And it wasn't just describing, it included describing disparities, but it was about a conceptual framework for thinking about those disparities and how they should lead us to redesign the kind of studies that we do of disparities in Latino populations, not the same as for other populations. And then I also read an empirical study that he was a senior author, Josh Breslow was the first author. It was a comparison of Mexican and U.S. households in terms of conduct disorder, and looking at both cross-national effects, but also the effects of migration and then intergenerational effects among Mexicans in the United States on conduct disorder. And I think it shows sort of a rigor of design that is difficult to achieve. He asked me not to go on too long, so I'll stop here. He's had somebody with so many awards and papers and so forth, it's difficult to summarize. I'll just mention that he's in the Institute of Medicine, and that one of the many things that he did there was to chair the IOM Roundtable on Health Equity and Disparities. So it's somebody that you can really admire and feel good about giving this award to, William Vega.
Okay. Wait a minute, let me put this down then.
Okay. So,
I guess you would get it.
A formal comment. If somebody could take a picture of that, it would make it just like put on our website.
I know they don't want it for their family album, so I'll probably get a copy at some point. Thank you so much.
If you could send the picture to Jean also, because then we'd have it on record.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a wonderful introduction, and I want to thank the section and the people who did the selecting for honoring me in this way. It's very satisfying after a long career where, as you know and I know, a lot of the times it's just like washing the dishes. There's so much extraneous work involved in our careers that are not directly related to the production of great articles, bureaucracy and struggling for funds and everything else that goes with it. But it's wonderful to be able to be here and look back at this work. It is, of course, for me, been very satisfying to be able to have a life course perspective and go forward and have done research on adolescents and adults as well, and now being in an aging an institute on aging and having a chance to look at the completion of that life course for a population. And I'm seriously contemplating applying for a job in afterlife studies too. It's like I'll be able to do interventions in the afterlife to make sure that we can take care of all of us, you know, at all ends of the life course. But it, trying to put this presentation together, I think for me, it really presented a particular challenge, because you have to be selective. You have to figure out how do you tell a story, and there's a lot of different things that went on in all your research career. And so, I had to selectively leave things in and out, frankly. I mean, because I did not really have the time, I didn't think, to get into the services research stuff that I've done, which has been extensive, and some of the clinical epidemiology I've done, looking at issues around diagnostic accuracy and serious mental disorders with African Americans and Latinos and whites. And there's a lot of other things that just really don't fit in the basket today, because I can't get them in and keep it coherent, to be perfectly honest with you. So what I'm going to do is really try to keep this moving along. I'm just saying to Ezra that I heard someone who was considered the top public speaker in the United States, and he said, audiences can't focus more than 13 minutes. Well, you're a special audience. Okay. I know you can do it. I know you have. I have full confidence in you. So what I'm going to do on my end of it is keep this as lively as I possibly can and keep this moving along. Okay, so I'm not going to try and sink you into too many facts. There is one little section with some tables in it, but for the most part, it'll be much faster than that. Now, the one thing I do want to ask about, we don't have a pointer, I take it, right, for this, because it's such a long way to the screen. And is. But that's okay. I can walk around.
He told me to do this to move the slides.
Oh, the slides. I know how to move. Yeah, but I just have no pointer. Okay. Yeah. No problem. So I just want to begin by, of course, we all have to give you the disclosure, and I have no conflicts to report in the last 12 months, and certainly in this field and not in my lifetime. So the overview of the study really hits on three issues that are the specific aims, basically, of this presentation. Explain the primary research evidence of risk for emotional distress and associated pathologies attributable to the migration experience. And I want to just say there that I use the term emotional distress because this is a hard field to represent, as it involves a lot of different types of psychiatric mental disorder states that we are still contesting as to whether they exist or not. Exactly, you know, how we would construe them under different, you know, constructions of a diagnostic taxonomy. So, you know, I emotional distress is usually a term used for children's disorders, and I think that's because it isn't as clear and concrete with children yet because they haven't developed into a clear phenotype. So I think maybe that would be the appropriate big umbrella under which to make this description go forward in this presentation. However, I will be saying psychiatric disorders and mental health, substance abuse, non-substance abuse problems in here. But I want you to know that's the reason I used emotional distress. Describe the key lines of social and public health research that enrich our understanding of resilience and vulnerability of migratory subpopulations, and finally identify key bridging areas of research with the greatest potential for public health policy and practice to advance the health of vulnerable migrant populations at the end. And I use the term migrant because a migrant subsumes immigration. I can't use immigration for example, Puerto Rico, because Puerto Rico is, you know, you're born a citizen in Puerto Rico, so they're migrants. So I think migrant is a bigger umbrella under which to kind of catch the picture here. Now, for myself, I mean, I come out of, which I think is kind of funny, I come out of the sociological kind of tradition for looking at all of this, in a field, of course, which has been dominated by psychiatry, basically, from the standpoint of defining these diagnostic entities which we have studied, and for both children and for adults. And yet, you know, on the other hand, sociologists have gone out and do all the primary measurement, you know, on this kind of work, and psychologists have come into it most recently. But it really was sociologists in the beginning that were doing a lot of this work. And so it was, I kind of, you know, if you remember the community mental health movement, it used to be a war between social workers and psychiatrists, and this turned into a war between sociologists and psychiatrists. Because there were a lot of disagreements along the way in trying to determine what is it that we're measuring and how should we measure it. And I raise this issue for one important reason, because in the end, the tool, the instrument, has its own law. Some of these instruments that we've used in the history of large-scale psychiatric epidemiology and measurement, you know, produce vastly different results than other ones. And so that's something that I want to put forward from the very beginning and let you know that we struggled with this, you know, this issue back in the late 1970s and the early 1980s. You know, we came to call it procedural validity because it really was more like reliability than it was a demonstration of validity. We didn't really have firm validity evidence to demonstrate that these were really clear-cut, discrete diagnostic categories, or were they in fact overlapping kind of categories, which was argued by some of the people that did the original Midtown Manhattan study, that they really said, well, these are really not clear-cut categories. You should measure these things dimensionally, you know, not as discrete entities. But that debate, you know, went on and goes on to this day. And I assure you that in other places, for example, in Europe and in the UK, they have great misgivings about the use of DSM taxonomies for the purpose of what we do. And I remember reading the work of Eisenach, who's a very, very prominent psychiatrist. I don't know if he's even alive anymore, but he had a famous line in a book that he published about DSM, and he said, if DSM-5 ever emerges, he said, it would be, I think he said, the most disfigured child ever been born. It was something to that effect. So, you know, there isn't universal acclaim for taxonomies, and if you measure the taxonomies differently, you also get different results. And so we found a variance of, you know, 50% in using one type of measurement instrument, the diagnostic interview schedule, versus the CD, which was later used by Ron Kessler, who Ron Kessler basically invented, and used his own style of case finding, and then used that for world use in 20 countries. So I think that you must understand that these issues around the rates are not as important, as far as I'm concerned, in what I'll be showing you today, as differences between groups, because there is consistency in that. Now the measures are different. In showing very different levels, even for the same groups, subgroups, but when you use these different instruments, they do show the same variation quite consistently, and that's my point here, that validity we won't worry about. The other thing is that it's important to realize where this work came out of in the history of all this, because Emile Durkheim, in his book Suicide, was the first to look at social organization and emotional distress. And this was a very long time ago. And it was when you first had massive urbanization in France, and people were coming out of traditional, you know, agricultural societies and moving to cities, and you saw for the first cases, I guess, of what you would call, you know, sort of a normlessness kind of environment and disconnectedness and what the impact was on individuals. And of course, for me, the most powerful evidence beyond that that really framed me from my entire career was the Chicago School of Sociology, which 100 years ago had already laid the platform for much of what we're doing today. Place effects, the social ecology effects, the intergenerational change. They were reporting on Mexican immigrants and their children and the differences between generations in 1910. And we're still going and presenting that like it's new. That's what's so amazing. In 1910, Sutherland described that in Chicago. So, you know, we've had these changes for a long time. And of course, they were famous for showing that people who were low risk for deviant behaviors, for example, in one environment, for example, they looked at African Americans in the South. They said they had low rates of these things. They come into Chicago, into this zone that was basically the so-called zone in transition, which was the high activity zone for everything that was not good. And all of a sudden, their behavior changed. And yet, as groups moved out of there, their behaviors went back down, you know, to a different level. So there was something about the area, the place, that was creating these effects. And so that place question came out of their work as well. And the latest Chicago work that's been done is so eminent. Also, is very much based on the earlier Chicago school. Just now we have statistics. We can do much better work with it. We have automated programs for looking at data. So it's not like the Chicago school people were doing it, you know, by hand. They didn't even have calculators, right? And the last issue is the potential association of emotional vulnerability with social status and social structure. So we're going to go through these. Now, remember, migration is something that has had a very long history, and especially circular migration from two sites. I mean, from Puerto Rico, there's been circular migration for a long time because it was easy entry, easy exit, because they were citizens. So there has been a tremendous continuous process. And we don't really completely understand how that has affected, you know, the culture of Puerto Rico. And when people grow up there, are they already sort of primed and pre-socialized, you know, for, you know, the United States, simply because if they haven't been to the United States, plenty of people they know have been. So it's a kind of unique kind of situation considering that when you compare them to other Latino groups, they're coming from countries that are countries. I mean, they're discrete countries with a discrete history, much of that history anti-American. Of course, much of Puerto Rico's history is anti-American too, but we'll leave that aside for the moment. Now, the immigration flow and restrictions, you know, there has been a presence of Mexican people, Mexican origin people in the United States for a long time because it was part of Mexico. It was part of Spain for hundreds of years. But that population was relatively small. It was the immigration that started up from about 1910 forward during the Mexican Revolution that really brought continuing cycles of immigration from Mexico. And it was estimated there was about 1.5 million Mexicans in 1930. Mexican origin people, and then, of course, the current estimate of Mexican origin people is about 33.7 million. About 12 million of these were born in Mexico. And migrants have very changeable situations, so it's difficult to study them because some, you know, come to the United States, they stay forever. Some come for a while, they go back. Some go back, stay for a while, come back again, and they just do this as a life, you know, life course thing because they work for periods of time in the United States when they need to, and we'll go back to Mexico the rest of the time. And that has very big kind of, we measured that to see what the differences was in mental health among those. And we found big differences as a result of those patterns, where the people who went back more were better off, frankly. went back for periods. So I just wanted just to give you real quick, and this, and I mean quick here. This is just the foreign-born population change projected from 1950, when it was about 10 million total foreign-born population in the United States, up to what is anticipated in 2050, which is 81 million. This is the Hispanic population, which obviously has a very similar, you know, a curve here, because obviously it's an overlap with the same population. So what you find with the total Hispanic population, because it is mostly driven by fertility, not immigration, even though immigration has an important place in this, the population size went from 6.3 million all the way up to, it's going to be projected at 128 million by 2050, which actually would mean it's as many Hispanics in the United States as there are in Mexico at that point. The U.S. population demographic changes, you know, the main big change I want to point out for you is that actually white non-Hispanics go down to below majority population. Hispanics go to nearly 30%. African Americans stay about the same, around 13%, and Asians around 9%. So having said all of that, let's get into looking at why I came upon the things that I wanted to do in my career and understand at a granular level and at intergenerational level, you know, why you had this change in mental health status in populations and why you had these differences. The first thing I'm going to present to you was the first study that ever appeared using field data. This was actually done by Bob Roberts, this was looking at comparisons of major depression and minor depression with the research diagnostic criteria, which preceded the use of the diagnostic interview schedule and certainly influenced its construction. And of course here, the impression was that the rates were similar, right? And I think this is important to point out, because I think that there was, at the beginning of all of this movement, an assumption that there was some sort of endogenous biological reason why we should expect these rates to look fairly similar in all groups. If these were really organic entities, these psychiatric disorders, they really had a root primarily in something that was heritable, then you would expect them to have similar, you know, kind of, you know, presence as we assume schizophrenia must all over the world, of a, you know, a consistent 0.5% or consistent 1%. And we assume that to be the case, right? We assume that that's true. I'm not sure it is true, but we assumed that it's true. And I think it was more or less assumed at this time as well. Now, of course, the big breakthrough came in the ECA program projects, which were, you know, across the country. I think there's 5 sites. One of them was LA. This was the first time that actually people took the time to try and look to see if there was a difference in race between a major ethnic population that was, you know, speaking a different language and all that, and you had to adapt the instrument for the different language. This was done in the LA ECA. This is back in 1985-86, published around 87. Of course, it was African Americans in this as well, because there were areas like Duke University involved in the study, and Yale, and they had African Americans in their samples. And it was very interesting, because for the first time, they were actually able to have sample sizes large enough to discern differences between foreign-born and U.S.-born of Mexican origin. And as you can see here, there were differences. I mean, the differences were about 50% or 100%. And there was really big differences in behaviors that are in fact learned, such as substance abuse. You know, the behaviors that you have to be into social context and you get into an initiation process and it becomes habituation. Alcohol abuse and alcohol dependence, you can see the difference in rates there between Mexican immigrants. Look at the alcohol dependence, 14.4, and that's almost all entirely males, I have to tell you. And then the Mexican-Americans born in the United States, 24.4. So there was a big increase there. And then, of course, the non-Hispanics were about the same as the foreign-born. So this produced a certain look at this, and we thought, well, there's big differences. Now, would those really reproduce? And so for me, it led me to say, you know, I want to do this and look at this in a very granular way, and so therefore I'm going to propose a study that gives me 5 times a sample, so I have much more to work with, because this was basically a sample of only, I think the ECA had a sample of Mexican origin around 650, and even the Inlets only had, I think, 600 or something like 580 or something like that. And so there's been very few studies that have had a big enough sample where you can really start taking it apart and go down and really look at 3 or 4 variables controlled simultaneously and show variability. It's hard to do this kind of research and with precision and have enough statistical power to say anything meaningful. So this study raised two big issues. One was the differences between the immigrants in the U.S. born and, you know, the non-Hispanic white population. But secondly, and very importantly, we didn't have any international data to test the notion that these are really reproducible rates that will go on all over the, you know, and no matter where we look at them. So all of that has been answered. I mean, I think this, it's been pretty well answered. Now, this was my study, and if you look at the, and I'll walk over there to do it because I don't have a way to show you quickly this, but what we did, we took the median time in country, which was 13 years in the United States for the immigrants. This was a big epidemiologic study in Central California with 3,000 people using the CD. The same one that was used in the study that in the National Comorbidity Survey, the DSM-3R in diagnosis. And it was also a study that we did in collaboration with our friends in Mexico City at the Psychiatric Institute in Mexico City. They did a community survey in Mexico City using the same case-finding instrument. So we were able to line those up then and look at the NCS rates in the American population based on Ron Kessler's work, Mexico City rates, and here I chose certain disorders because I don't want to spend all day on disorders. And then looking at immigrants, cutting them at the median of 13 years because that split the sample 50-50, and then looking at native-born Mexican-Americans, okay, in Central California. So it was a sample of, in this instance, it was 3,000 people. We have another 1,000 that was a farm worker sample. Those were not included in these estimates. So you can see the differences. All of a sudden, you look at something like a major depression, and you can see the huge differences in rates across the board. And I think what was interesting about this is that the Mexico City rates were, you know, far lower, and this is the first time any diagnostic instruments that have been used in Mexico were far lower than the U.S. total rates, which I think it tells you one thing, and it's very critical to understand, that there really isn't any Hispanic paradox. It's just that the immigrants are reflecting the lower rates in country of origin. That's what's going on here. There's no paradox on the mental health side, on the substance abuse side, or the non-substance abuse side. The rates are lower in these sending nations. And that's what they're experiencing. And I think that that was an enormous find, that to understand that indeed, you know, this is not something that comes from some special selection factor that only the strongest come over or the least likely to have, you know, these problems or whatever. It's clear that the sending nations themselves vary. And this has actually been amplified in later studies. This is the NESARC study that was done with a sample of 4,500 of Mexican origin, where Bridget Grant, who was the PI of this, looked at this to replicate this. She published this in American Journal of Psychiatry and replicated the rate differences that we found from the standpoint of these massive differences. You can look at any disorder difference. Foreign-born Mexican-Americans was 28% any disorder. It was 47.6% for U.S.-born. Foreign-born whites in the study, these were Europeans that were in the big NESARC study, their rate was 32%, and U.S.-born whites was 52.5%. So, you see, it wasn't a Hispanic paradox, it's just these people emerging from these different nations likely had different rates that were much lower than the United States of these different disorders. And when these were measured, when we finally started measuring these things, we began to find them all over the place. This has, again, been replicated, and I'll show you in just a minute, by Maggie in a paper that came out of the CPES, which is combined data sets from the NCSR and the NLAS and the Asian American study. This is that paper. And this line here, it's turquoise in color, shows you the difference. These are any lifetime DSM disorder, and this turquoise line are the Mexican origin people. The ones when the U.S. had about 40% rate, the ones the foreign born are way down here, about, you know, half of that rate. And here's non-Latino white, U.S. born immigrants. Okay? And then the only group that stayed relatively stable, doesn't have that much of a difference, are in fact Puerto Ricans. The foreign-born and the U.S.-born look fairly similar. And that's primarily driven by the differences in rates of substance abuse, because what we find with the Puerto Rican males, not females, but males, is that they basically are flat on substance abuse. Whereas the women have a big difference. I mean, it's about a 4 times difference in substance abuse dependence rate, you know, for over a lifetime. So it's there's definitely a difference in the situation that we see in Puerto Rico than we see for any of the other groups operating in this comparison. So you can see the consistency that I was talking about. There is consistency in these findings, in these differences between foreign-born and U.S.-born. We thought at first it was just okay, just these people in L.A. Now we start looking around and we see it's from all people from all over the world that have these differences, not just from L.A. And this is just substance abuse disorders, and that sort of just shows you it's the same thing. It replicates the same thing, but it's just looking at nothing but substance abuse, abuse and dependence over a lifetime. Okay, and this is the World Health Organization. There's actually 24 different countries in this, but I just used four to give you the example. I was just trying to show you mainly the comparison between the U.S. and Mexico. This is from the World Health Organization Initiative, and I threw in Nigeria and Germany just to give you two other continental comparisons. And what it really shows you there is that this is a projection that was done statistically to show if you weighted this out, what would you have over a lifetime in terms of rates, all right? Which is a different approach at 75. This is modeled to at 75 years of age, what do you expect to see as lifetime rates, right? And you can see Mexico is two-thirds of the rates of the United States. But look at places like Nigeria, where if you've ever been to Nigeria, you know what a difficult world that is. I mean, Nigeria is, I've worked in Nigeria, and it's a destitute country with enormous levels of conflict. It's had conflict continuously for about 40 years, civil war, everything. I mean, now they have guerrilla action on all fronts, and it's a hard country to live in, to survive. And yet, look at their projected lifetime risk. So, you know, again, is this an instrument issue? I don't know. I can't answer that question, but those rates, you know, the whole issue of the stress effects on mental health, you look at something like this, and believe me, they're under stress in Nigeria. And I don't understand really, you know, I can't explain all of these things. But bottom line is that, you know, Mexico, the United States, those rates again look again very similar, basically about 30%, 33% difference between rates overall, much higher for substance abuse. And this is dual diagnosis, co-occurring substance abuse, non-substance abuse disorders. I just want to show you two things. At the very bottom is the Mexican origin people compared. These are people that have both things at the same time. They both have a psychiatric disorder, there's a substance abuse disorder, and a non-substance abuse disorder. Look how low it is. If you look at the men versus women, and you look at the Mexican origin immigrants, only 0.5% of women in the Mexican origin immigrant group that are female have a dual diagnosis, 0.5%. And the Mexican origin males, it's about 4%. But then you look at the U.S. born, and look at 19.47%. Okay, you can see the impact that immigration has. And then this is taken from a study that I actually got this guy to do it because he wasn't going to publish it. This is from the work of Escamilla and his company, and this particular one is from one of his people, Jimenez Castro. And this is from a schizophrenia twin study in Costa Rica, Mexico, and the United States with Mexican origin people. And, you know, in the United States and at the NIH, they will always tell you that mental health problems and substance abuse problems have a common origin. They have common determinants derived from common traits. And it's just a question of which one comes first, and it's usually the mental health problem that comes first. Well, I haven't found that. I found that with Latino populations, it's usually the substance abuse problem that comes first. And look at this difference in rates for in marijuana dependence for men in Costa Rica among people with schizophrenia, which is a population here that we figure about 65-70% of those have a substance dependence problem. Costa Rica, 8.3. Mexico, 13. U.S., 29.5. Women, Costa Rica, 0. Mexico, 3.4. U.S., 9.1. Now, remember, Mexico is a trafficking country. There's plenty of cocaine in Mexico. It's not that it's not available. Alcohol, Costa Rica, this is alcohol abuse or dependence. Costa Rica, 27.1. Mexico, 18.7. U.S., 38.5. And women, Costa Rica, 5.9. Mexico, 1.7%. U.S., 15.2. And of course, you know, you might say, well, isn't that just, that could just be an artifact. They're lying because they don't want to tell you about it. And we were just talking about this a little earlier because we actually did. We had the opportunity to do a study with 30,000 women anonymous urine toxicology screening in California. And it absolutely substantiated the differences in these ethnic group rates. The rates for any kind of illicit drug use among immigrant Latinas, and I'm not saying they were all Mexican-American because they weren't. We couldn't discern that, but they were Latinas. And among the foreign-born, it was virtually zero. It ranged among the other U.S. ethnic groups up to 9%. So, you know, obviously a big difference. This is a presentation for delivery. Okay, when they have to give a urine sample, and we got half of that urine sample anonymous with no... It was the one and only study ever done like this, because after that, as I was saying earlier, it's illegal now to do that kind of study. It's considered unethical to not inform. But this study was done a long time ago, and it was actually a special issue article for New England Journal of Medicine. So it wasn't in the world of unpublishable study. So I think it does show... You know, these different. Look at cocaine, it's the same thing. Costa Rica, zero for women. New Mexico, zero for women. And 6.1% in the United States. Look at that jump up in rates for women. It's still low by U.S. standards. Still very low by U.S. standards. But you can see the changing normative structure of the United States versus these other countries, and the difference in processes that are social. And I think that's where my interest automatically went, to figure out, well, how does this happen? How fast does it happen? And why does it happen? So, of course, you know, I have to give you Marmot here, because, as he said, it's not the social position in the hierarchy per se is the culprit, but what the position in the hierarchy means for one can do in a given society. The degree of autonomy, mastery, and social participation, control. But I have to caution and say that this is socially, culturally interpreted, because you can see the variation in these rates across these countries and across these groups that are very powerless in many of these societies. So there is a social construction issue here. It's not universal. So that's, I think, one of the things we have to be very careful about in thinking about these things, because we know, for example, that there's enclave effects where you have Spanish-speaking people that are protective for the English-speaking people of the same ethnic group, and actually has an effect on them that's positive. So, you know, and they're very low income. I mean, you know, these immigrants, a lot of these immigrant communities, you know, the average education level, 6th, 7th, 8th grade. They're very high on stress levels associated with occupation, and they're very high on stress levels around other issues of life, like parenting, etc. But, you know, they don't show those same levels of substance abuse and all these other things, at least not in the beginning. As you say, after 13 years, you get changes. You start seeing these changes, but they never rise to the point of getting nearly as high as U.S.-born people. So there is a temporary effect. But what this does, it produces an effect that in the denominator of any epidemiologic estimate, you're going to have a sensitivity to what percentage of that base is foreign-born. And this is also true, by the way, for a number of other diseases, you know, not just issues associated with psychiatric disorder. I'm talking about even physical health states. Because actually Latinos live longer in the American population by a factor of about 2 years than the general population of the United States, but it's mostly all immigrant effects. And so, you know, as you get a change in the composition of American society, which is certainly going to occur now with the decline of immigration in the United States, you will see increasing rates, you know, likelihood of these things, because as you fill up that denominator primarily with U.S.-born people, especially children of immigrants who are very low income and have very little social mobility, that's what I believe we can anticipate. So I think there's two things involved here. One has to do with the context in which their socialization is taking place, because there's issues around, you know, segmentation of assimilation. It's a very different thing, you know, to be growing up in you know, one type of site like San Antonio, Texas, for example, versus Miami, versus New York City. And there's also the question of when you are exposed to these things, because we know now from studies that have been done, including the adolescent study we did in Miami, and then later on with the EPI, the big national EPI study, if you come in under the age of 12, you basically are going to have the same risk level as if you had been here since you were born. So it's no salvation to be foreign-born. It's not a magic process. It's not an inoculation. If you're here for those first 12 years, in the study in Miami, we had five measurement points at 11 and a half all the way up to 22. And we saw no difference there, ultimately, in rates of that were significant between dependence and abuse among those kids, because they had all come in as children. And so there was, and then the same thing was replicated when Maggie Alegria did the, you know, the NLAS study. I mean, it's the same thing. There's no difference. People under 12 are same risk. So we know that socialization and exposure is critical. And of course, that again, it's not this uniform in every site that you go to in the United States, but as a population, that's what seems to occur. So for me, that leads to the what I would call context dependence question of, you know, because in the end, not everybody, for example, that uses a drug becomes addicted to a drug, even if it's an addictive drug. In fact, what the literature shows is 1 in 10 people who use an addictive drug actually become drug dependent. And of course, that leads to assumptions about heritability and the whole heritability school of genetics, which really puts almost even the social behaviors associated with substance dependence into the realm of being something you inherit. Now, this is all becomes heritable as a sort of a process. And I had some citations like that. I took them out because this thing was too long. But I think it's important to understand how that works. And I take this work from Richard Cooper. And in the original one, it was not Mexico and the U.S. His original model was Africa. Okay, it was Africa on the left and U.S. on the left. It was West Africa versus the U.S. And what he was looking at and trying to explain the difference in was high blood pressure. And what he said was hypertension and people who have a predisposition, which we will call the gene variant, which is the VP, the GVP, is a gene variant present, you know, and for people who don't have that gene variant for high blood pressure, would have very similar rates in a place like West Africa in that environment. They would have a similar rate. He said, in the United States, the people with a gene variant absent that don't have that propensity might rise a little bit, but they basically would stay very similar to the place where they'd come from. But the people with the gene variant present would really increase in the new context of the United States under the kinds of pressures that African Americans operate in this country. You know, the discrimination and all the processes of the violence and trauma, et cetera. So, that's an interesting kind of a model, I think, to apply to substance abuse, for example, if not other non-substance disorders, in the case of Mexico, U.S., because obviously something happens in the process of coming over here. The younger you are, the more likely it's going to happen. But it's selective. I mean, I would argue that it is selective in terms of who is, in fact, susceptible to in the mental disorders, you know, that are either substance abuse or non-substance abuse. So, as I just indicated, only 1 in 10 people actually become dependent on drugs, and genetic susceptibility, though, is very, very complex, and we certainly cannot go to a model and from what the data that we've got to show that this is something that just happens automatically to just a few people. And I'm going to show you that in just a moment. So this cumulative adversity kind of belief, you know, that people exposed to more difficult circumstances will be more susceptible to mental health problems has been demonstrated over and over again by Jay Turner and lots of other stress researchers have shown that there is, in fact, a cumulative impact of these things on you. And it's also true for substance abuse. Jay and I actually cooperated on that Miami study, and he had some data from that he published about 7 years ago. And this is from the Miami study with the five waves, 11.5 to people who are 22. And this is the conditional probability of having drug dependence, DSM-4 drug dependence, based again on the NCR, you know, instrument, right? And all of, you see, this is cumulative adversity, you know, on the bottom axis there, you see 0 to 10. And what you show is a linear effect. More exposure to cumulative adversity, the more likely you're going to be dependent. The only group that was not was African Americans. And this has been shown in study after study. So again, it goes back to the issue of how you appraise the circumstances that you're living in as stressful or not stressful. How do you interpret the signal that's coming out of that stress? Okay, and that's the point I want to make. Yeah. There we go. So this is the actual kind of life course adaptation model that I used that I published about 20 years ago. And I thought it would just be good for guiding people's thinking about this because it borrowed on the best of the sociological models by Ruben Rumbau and Alejandro Portes, who were experts in immigration. And it borrowed on the notion of context of exit and conditions under which you leave your country and then conditions that you experience when you enter the country. And I think it's a good model even for understanding international immigration all over the world because there's a lot of it going on and to all different kinds of sites. But in the United States circumstance, we have a situation where people are coming from, in the context of Mexico or Central America, from very poor countries, and the vast difference in the United States change in terms of the income differential and the status differential is just huge. I mean, Mexico, you know, poverty level is 40%, and this is now. Now when it's better. It used to be 60. All right, just a few years ago, it's really changed in the last 20 years or so in Mexico. It's about 40% right now. So the notion here was simply to show the flow of what happens in the processes of change, not just to individuals, but to families and intergenerationally. So the immigrant experience itself and the circumstances of leaving and all of the problems that that brings when you break up families, emotional cutoff, you separate children from parents for a while, quite often. It's like 40% of kids are cut off from the parents for long periods of time, and then they reunite most of the time, not always. And then the acculturation process itself of learning new societies and their ways. And of course, what a lot of work has gone into, which I won't even attempt to disentangle, the acculturation process and the stressful part of that, which is like you don't speak the language. You don't really understand the customs. You don't really know how to do various things that seem very complex in the bureaucracies, or how you seek health care, or how you get a driver's license, and why things are the pattern the way they are in the United States. And then, of course, the acculturation stress, which differentiates itself, not just at the family level, but it differentiates itself because the family level, you know, it's interpreted as differences in generations, and because they're acculturating, you know, and they have certain conflicts. But the individual people going through this process, parents have very different acculturation issues that they face when they come into the United States than do the children. The parents have the occupational issue, money. How do you survive? Children have an immediate acute crisis going to schools where they don't speak the language, and they're not socialized into the American school system. They're not part of those networks, and they must blend into it. But they don't come into a blank sheet because they were pre-existed by second and third generation kids from that same ethnic group and from other ethnic groups, especially in these low-income areas. So I know whenever we model this type of data, and we do a lot of modeling, believe me, I wrote a book on this, literally a book, on adolescents going through this process. And you know what we find, no matter how you do it, yeah, you find certain things that come through quite coherently. One is the fact that family cohesion is so powerful for Latinos. It comes through very powerfully as uniquely, very strong and strongly protective and risk-enhancing, both, if it's not present. And the other issue that comes through, you know, very clearly in this type of research is that, you know, the process of this acculturation cycle does move differently, you know, for people at different ages. And parents, you know, need about 8 years before they really seem to hit the acculturation crisis point, and it seems to be related to their occupational trajectories. That what they have to do is start speaking, to advance, they have to start speaking enough English and be knowledgeable enough about the system so they can start making a living that's somewhat better. They want to, you know, they want to better their situation, have steady employment and income. And they have a very different window. So the parents and the kids are going through this, you know, in the households at the same time. And I've seen it, you know, up close, and I know how often these parents feel diminished, and they feel that the change of roles, especially women become much more powerful in these households in the United States. The kids themselves, you know, have the issue where they become, you know, the interpreters for their parents, and that's an empowering role as well. So you have a lot of status inversions that come in this and adjustments that have to be made. And of course, segmented assimilation, which is something that comes out of the work of Alejandro Portes and Zhao, and really what it meant was that there's different types of communities. Miami is built on a political and economic community that has an enormous potential for linking people of Cuban background into jobs. They're immediately they're put into a situation to get U.S. citizenship right away. I mean, they're really organized. In Cuba, before the revolution, they were organized in municipios. They've reorganized these municipios in Miami. And people who, whatever municipio they came from, they're linked to that municipio in Miami, and they get this whole process of networking, you know, right away. It's an amazing process of social integration that's deliberate and structured and is very effective. Now, we actually had a chance in this research to compare, you know, the processes that occurred for Nicaraguans versus Cubans, because we had a big sample of Nicaraguans in Miami when we did the adolescent study. We did find huge differences between those two in the level of acculturative stress that they were reporting when they were from the same income groups, simply because some were integrated and considered it a home-like environment. The Cubans, they were within, you know, the enclave that they had constructed. The Nicaraguans were 90% undocumented. They'd come during a revolution, you know, in their country that was very violent. and they had the worst of circumstances with very few resources. So they were working for the Cubans, basically, in Miami. So they had very different kinds of outcomes, and it really affected the children. I mean, the cumulative impacts were quite different of the acculturation and stress experienced by parents and children in combination, additively, on their children in one group versus the other group. Well, let me go back to that one just for a second. So, protective factors of immigrants, the Spanish language enclaves have a protective effect because they retain certain cultural normative structures, obviously. The circuit of migration had a protective effect that I told you about earlier, that people who go back to the place of origin in Mexico, for example, and spend longer periods of time, we found was definitely protective. The adverse of that was the Indians that come from Mexico, which had higher risk and advanced to higher risk. The Indians that come from Mexico don't speak Spanish very well. They have very small Spanish language vocabularies. They were never integrated into Mexican society. They come to the United States, and they go into English much more quickly because they're not going into enclaves of Mexican people. They're sort of a population apart. So the acculturation of the kids just takes place like this into English. And their movement, you know, up the ladder of risk for things like drug use and for depression is more rapid. And they have no enclave protective effects. Then the social networks, emotional support, family reformation is very, very important. And migrants do report higher family cohesion. In fact, I did research on families early in my career when people were studying these models, like the multiplex model. Do you remember something like that? There were models of families where they would describe whether the family was dysfunctional. They finally gave up with those models because the Mexican families were considered all dysfunctional, because they were so highly cohesive that they were considered enmeshed, which was a category that was defective and pathological. And yet we see clearly it was the protective factor here. Even the cohesion measure in the NLAS, for example, in the National Latino and Asian American study, is in fact the one we used, that we took from the original circumplex model 20 years before and used it in our studies in Miami, and then it was used again in the NLAS. So it's very consistent pattern, and papers have reported on this over and over again of that cohesiveness effect. And of course, for migrant women, driving a car. This is very similar to what they're reporting. We reported this 25 years ago. No, more than that. 35 years ago we reported that as a protective factor against depression for migrant women. But this is what they're saying right now in Saudi Arabia, right? These women are saying, hey, if we can drive, you can't control us anymore. It's a control issue, you know. That's what it's all about, driving. It isn't because the car gives you a magical effect on your mental health. No, it's because it represents independence, right? You can move at your own pace, and you have a different opportunity. And so these issues come together, and I won't re-review these because I think I've talked about those enough. But I think that what I just described to you, as the problem that results from these combination, acculturation stress things of parents and children, does contribute in combination to the underlying low self-esteem, which we actually have in an article we call The Two Different Worlds. This is the one on Cubans versus Nicaraguans. And I think it also is a contribution to the high suicide ideation you see in Latinas. There's a very high suicide ideation rate that's been reported over and over again among Latinas. Now, this is the last big piece that I'm going to give you in this presentation. I think it's very interesting. We actually had the question in our big study in Central California, and we're the only ones that have been able to report this because we're the only ones that included this question. We had the question on, this is to adult respondents now, did your mother or father, and we asked them separately, did your mother or your father, and I'm going to read you this. This is the exact wording that we use because I don't want to give you a bogus version of it. Did your biological father, and then we'd ask it alternately about mother, have periods of a month or more where he or she was constantly nervous, edgy, or anxious? Did your biological mother or father have a problem with drinking? Did he or she ever have a problem with illegal drugs? Did your mother or father ever have problems lasting 2 weeks or more where he or she was depressed or down in the dumps most of the time? And of course, we didn't say the dumps in Spanish, but we had other vocabulary for that. The bottom line, though, is that what we found was that the U.S.-born were much more likely to report that the parents had these problems. And you can see that they are sensitive to the issue because these are, we're reporting here, immigrants with and without drug abuse or dependence, and U.S.-born with or without drug abuse or dependence. And you can see that clearly those that have more of these parental risk factors, one or more of these parental risk factors, were much more likely and they might have occurred in combination, of course, you know, these risk factors, but much more likely to have a disorder that's a alcohol abuse or dependence here than a U.S.-born without drug abuse or dependence. So, yes, it is an intergenerational process from the standpoint that there is risk contributed by parental behavior, and if the parents have been in the country longer, or if they're U.S.-born, which is most likely for these U.S.-born with drug abuse or dependence, obviously not for immigrants, they're simply more likely to report the drug abuse or dependence. Now, this is for fathers, father risk factors. And I'll tell you, we looked at the extra factor of, do you have no knowledge of your father? And no knowledge of your father, it has a bigger impact on all of these factors. Especially for males. It has a massive impact on the males. This is mother. And in both of these, by the way, you see that there's almost no illicit drug use problem except for the U.S. born with drug abuse or dependence. It's just not reported. The fathers weren't doing that until you see the most highly acculturated people. Same thing here with mothers. You just don't see it. It's just not a factor. But for women, as opposed to men, as the usual, you know, we all know this, that whereas mothers have very low, alcohol being reported, see, mother alcohol problems, very low, except for the ones who are most acculturated. So now you see mother anxiety and mother depression are the big ones there on the mother's side. Well, what we did, and I think this is absolutely the most fascinating thing that I, in that period of which I was doing this research, that we came up with, and we had similar results, by the way, for illicit drug use. I just don't want to show too much stuff. But this is basically an array going from the least acculturated to the most acculturated. You're starting out with female immigrants with less than 13 years in the country that speak Spanish all the time. And then we vary it up in increments, increasing the acculturation proxies with more time in country and becoming more bilingual. At the upper end of the last two comparisons, what we show you is just people who are U.S. born. The one on the extreme right are English all or most of the time among English groups, obviously be the super acculturated ones. The ones just to the left of that are the bilingual U.S. born women and Mexican American women born, you know, in the United States. So what we see is, I think, absolutely fascinating. For those that have no risk factors, no parental risk factors, acculturation does absolutely nothing to increase their risk of alcohol abuse or dependence. Nothing. It has no effect. For the ones who have the risk factors, it still has no effects until you hit the parameter of the female immigrants with more than 13 years in the country between 18 and 44 who are bilingual. Those are the first ones that you begin to see an increase in those rates. And then, of course, when you get to the U.S. born, you see this huge shift upward, especially with the U.S. born English speaking all the time on the other end. So what it really shows you in this particular projection here is that only in the context of having family risk factors and high acculturation do you get this alcohol dependence, movement towards alcohol abuse or dependence that you see here. Otherwise, the acculturation thing doesn't do anything for women. It's an incredible statement about how conservative Mexican culture is. In Mexico, it's the same thing. There's just no use. There's no drug dependence, alcohol dependence, that hardly measurable in Mexico. It's so different from males because there's a lot of alcohol dependence in Mexico among males. You know, it's not as high as here, but it's high. So you can see it's very gender roles specific in socialization and control of gender. And this is males for alcohol abuse or dependence. It's you can see that the bottom line here, even though you have some variation in the rates because we had small cell sizes there on that second from the right, you know, it's the same thing, the same kind of array. But I think the point here is very simple, really. What it shows you is, yes, the risk factors have some effect, but frankly for males, with risk factors or no risk factors in terms of a parental risk factors and presumed heritability, they still have a high propensity in the United States under high acculturation conditions to become alcohol dependent and have alcohol abuse. So, you know, I think it really shows two different things. I mean, it shows massive differences in gender effects of acculturation and, you know, the combination of acculturation and these familial risk factors. But that for males, you know, yes, it's not unimportant that you have the risk factors, but you know what? Environment's very powerful for males for externalizing disorders, something we already basically know. because rates are always higher for males of substance abuse. And obviously, it's likely that the heritability factor is simply not nearly as important in this group either. Not that we measured that directly, because we did not do that. But in the study that was mentioned at the beginning in the introduction, that study that took place looking at conduct disorder, that found the same thing. What they reported there was that people in Mexican families that stayed in Mexico that had adult children that stayed in the country, they had the lowest rates of conduct disorder. The ones that they measured in the United States, in the first generation that came over, had higher rates than the ones left behind. But then the next generation, the second generation Mexican American, had even higher rates. It escalated up to a higher, just as you would predict from everything we've looked at here. But even those rates were lower than the U.S. general population rates of conduct disorder. So I think that's about as good as we've been able to do with the kind of data that we have today. And there's more and more work on what happens with these people that go back, because they spend a lot of time here and then they go back. And what we're finding in Mexico is that the families, both wives and children and the kids, because it's mostly males, it isn't just males, have higher rates. Women have higher rates of depression, and the kids have more conduct problems. So this led me to this conclusion that we published in a paper at that time, which I think really sums it up. These findings suggest that family biosocial factors have a reciprocal relationship with environmental processes of social and cultural assimilation in affecting the likelihood of alcohol abuse and dependence onset. While transmission of genetic risk is dependent on biological mechanisms, the expression of alcohol abuse and dependence may be subordinate to social and cultural factors. In the context of genetic predisposition to alcohol dependence, gender structures the importance of social and cultural factors. What remains unexplained is whether gender effects are purely a product of culturally prescribed normative expectations or mutually affected by biological factors, such as maternity, for example. So, what is the real mental health paradox? Social structural forces have variable effects on risk for emotional distress in different societies. We see that from the results of everything we've done. What can be learned from the superior mental health outcomes of other societies and U.S. migrant groups? Because even when we measure it inside the country, we see these differences. And this is the real question, what barriers exist to learning from these inconsistencies? Because there is such an ideological barrier for Americans to accept the idea that people coming from societies in which they were poor and they come here to have a better living, which they do get, and to have a better opportunity for their children to do well in this country, could actually have superior mental health. I mean, it seems impossible, or superior health for that reason. How could that possibly be? So you can't move that forward. It just hits a wall of comprehension or lack of comprehension. And I think there'd be an enormous amount to be learned from that. What is it about the composition and constitution of these people and their social order, and their mini social order in the United States, that permits this to exist for a while at least, and does have general effects in places where they're well constituted and do have some form of cohesive enclave? You didn't enjoy this. This is the Mexican Revolution, what they used to call the soldaderas that used to accompany the soldiers, you know, and shoot it out too, and keep up the supply of weapons that had ammunition in them. And this is the period that it really was the cause of when I think it was 20% of the entire Mexican population in Mexico from 1910 to 1920 moving to the United States in the first big immigration wave. Long-term effects of low income are absolutely clear-cut, because the stagnation intergenerationally with no opportunity is, I believe, and from everything we have seen with concentrated poverty effects, what causes that second generation of kids. That second generation of kids and the third generation make up 75% of the total Latino population. Okay, only 25% are immigrant right now. So this is a group that, you know, is extraordinarily high risk in the United States, because the reproduction rate of Latinos, and I mean, it's the highest, it's the most highly reproductive, it's the most fertile group in the country. Everybody else is not even at replacement rates right now. I mean, we're just barely hanging in there, you know, and it's Latino contribution to that population that's providing, you know, the continuing increase of population in this country. And if you look at kids under 5 right now in the country, it's about 60% Latino births in the United States right now. So who's going to fill up those foster homes 10 years from now? Who's going to fill up those correctional facilities? In California, it's already close to 70% of the correctional facilities are Latino kids. I mean, it's coming on with enormous power And, you know, we know it from a demographic perspective. They know it at the social service level because all these places across the country and all these different states are facing something they never saw before. They have to serve people in Spanish, and they don't understand these families. I've seen it even where in the Northeast, because I lived in Princeton for 7 years, where, for example, the provider system was set up to serve Puerto Ricans, and they really have a hard time dealing with the Mexican Indians who are living there from Oaxaca. They don't understand them. They don't understand their cultural styles and the family construction that they do and the family dynamics. It's just going to be an enormous process with high acceleration in the change of what we see in that group under 20 years of age over the next 20 years. And it won't take very long to happen because it's happening already. And, of course, the issues around the propensity for low-income areas to have persistent life stress, trauma, fewer resources available within those families impacts that second and third generation group that stays back and is unable to have any social mobility. And the segmented assimilation may be protective, but it has very selective effects. And it even has selective effects in areas for people that live in it. Now, this I don't expect you to read or comprehend, but I put it up for a reason. There's an enormous amount of excellent research going on now looking at the effects of adverse socialization, adverse trauma, and the lack of social support and its effects on your cellular system. It's called induction, and they're looking at how cells respond and actually miscode in cellular transcription, leading to heightened propensity towards inflammation. Now, this is the cell signaling school of researchers that are doing this work. They're mostly biological psychologists that are doing this work. There's centers around the country that are doing this work. And, you know, it's something that is going side by side, I think, and very, very consistent with the social stress research we've done for the last 35 years, because they are finding that, yes, those loads of social stress, like cumulative adversity, doesn't just produce greater substance abuse and greater depression. It actually has effects on the cells. It actually reduces our immune system capacity to deal with these, because you start having errors in the transcription process that potentially lead to very serious consequences in the body. So, to me, the other side of this key is the cell signaling. That's the side that they don't look at very effectively because they're using smaller samples. But the reality is that at some point we have to understand the difference in the way people address trauma, evaluate that trauma, and assign a meaning to that trauma. And that meaning that's assigned to that trauma and the ability to cope with it, you know, is makes a difference on whether or not this cell signal comes through as an adverse biological effect or not. So to me, I think if there's a future for the kind of research that we have been doing in the past that I've done, for example, in the last 30, I'm not saying I'm going to do this in the last 35 years or so, it's that. You know, we have an opportunity to cross that bridge from the stress induction process, because we can measure it on the outside, because people report the events and we know that they've been through it for a whole variety of different reasons, but we also can look at the outcomes of this. So, in the end, I would quote George Albee, because I'm certainly not for a genetic approach to dealing with these kinds of large-scale population issues. No mass disorder afflicting mankind has ever been eliminated or brought under control by attempts at treating the affected individual, nor by training large numbers of individual practitioners. My recommendations, research-wise, for binational family sibling research and also for non-siblings, from same areas of migration points should be done and compared with people who do migrate. So I think it's very interesting, I think, to look at this and to look at models of stress, measure biological indicators of it, and look at the behavioral outcomes and look at the biological repercussions. But you have to do this in a way that's really sequenced and very coordinated on both sides of the border to get this effectively done. Will it happen? I doubt it, because right now we're not interested in this kind of research. Right now we're interested in intervention research. So it's not likely it's going to happen too quickly. And there's only so much we can do with self-report, frankly. Life course research examining effects of early social disadvantage and embedding of biological disadvantage over the life course. I think this is absolutely critical. Now, as we just talked about, we have a storehouse of young people with tremendous disadvantage for mobility educationally and tremendously low incomes, and parents who have very low incomes in education. So if we want to understand this, we do have to understand it from a life course perspective in that early embedding process that Eileen Crimmins, who's an expert at this and done so much work in this, reports. And, you know, what I've seen other people reporting, Mexican kids, for example, babies are born very healthy, and they're born healthy, you know, good weights, especially the immigrant kids. The children of immigrants, they're very healthy weights. But when you look at their cognitive functioning and development at the age of six, they've fallen off. They have fallen off by then. So the question of what we can do on an ongoing basis, you know, because so many of these kids, I mean, I see it every day. I see these women cleaning houses, and they take the kids with them. You know, no preschool for them. They just accompany their mother, and they're bored and goofing around while their mothers are cleaning a house. You know, I know we had the whole problem of the undocumented, and I realize that this is a sub rosa population. It's very difficult to do much about it officially. But if we let this go, because we're talking about a lot of people here and a lot of children, and ultimately it's going to have very negative effects on our ability to turn this situation around. Obviously, there's also very practical things we can do by providing opportunities for different kinds of educational experiences, including trade, you know, development, you know, for different kinds of things that are not college, per se. And then improving our understanding of structural effects on mental health among ethnic groups. Right now, you know, only 13% of the Latino population graduates from college, 13%. And that is a stable figure that has not changed over about the last decade or so. So hopefully, you know, our future will be one in which we can, in fact, reach these populations. You know, they can conserve the best of their cultures. They can conserve the cohesiveness of their families because they have structures in which it's possible to do so and environments in which it's possible to do so. I don't think that that's entirely an impossibility. I think that there will be some conservation because even Mexican Americans, frankly, even with everything they've faced in terms of their existence in these low-income neighborhoods, still have actually better outcomes than you see in the overall U.S. population marginally. But, you know, there's an enormous amount of substance abuse-related problems especially. I mean, that is a really serious, serious epidemic problem of both alcohol and illicit drug use occurring in Latino populations that becomes really endemic to those areas. And, of course, an enormous amount of violence in those areas as well. It has abated because we've done a lot effectively in gang areas, et cetera. But, you know, the long-term trend, if we want to advance the overall health of the U.S. population, has to be to address the fundamental issues of who will support me, who will support Ezra when we're, you know, in our dotage here. And, you switch from having three payers for everybody over 65 to having only two payers for every one of them. You know, that's what's going to happen. The aging population is going to produce a situation that, you know, you're going to rely on a population for putting in tax revenue that is less educated and less able to replicate the income production for revenue that was there before for the people who are now aging and are takers in the system. I'll stop with this. One of the amazing things that's so simple to understand out of the aging process and support, which I only recognized because I looked at it for once, we only have about 35 years in which we're actually productive and not dependent on somebody else. You realize that? On the life course, you're a child, especially in the U.S. today. I mean, my kids, I'm still supporting them, and they're, you know, they're in their late 20s. Okay, but the bottom line is until the kids get to be, you know, from kids to about 20, 21, and, you know, they're basically still takers. They're still on the dependency side. They're net takers. They're not net positive in terms of producing revenue for the society. This downturn of revenue, you hit a peak, you know, when you're in your late, in your 20s, 30s, you know, in your 40s. But then at 55, it starts going down again. So you've got this little window, you know, about 35 years, where you can count on, at a population level, revenue coming in at peak, this positive rather than negative in terms of the balance on how much you pull out versus how much you're putting in. So, you know, think about that. So if we only got 35 years, you want those 35 years to really be able to sustain the overall society and not make undue drain on social services and correctional systems and all the rest of that unnecessarily because we have produced conditions that make that, you know, inevitable. So that in a nutshell is it, folks. That's, you know, I've tried to just give you an understanding of how I stage through this work, thinking about life course, granularity, intergenerational change, and how we tried to look at risk factors, protective factors. We did a lot of publishing on risk and protective factors. I think we found out a lot of things, and yet there's a lot in this basket that really is not satisfactorily answered. And I think the real question is a societal question and can't be answered, you know, by this type of research. Because in the end, this migrant advantage is a temporary one. It's temporary for these families, it's temporary for the society, and in the end it's going to turn into something different. So, you know, we all have that warning bell, but I can tell you that when I published my work on this, I would get these nasty emails from people out there, or in letters written to me, and say, well, if you think it's so much better for migrants, why don't you go back where you came from?
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know how our society is. I mean, you got people out there that take this as an offense. It's a lie. It's propaganda. You're making it up. You hate America. You know, that kind of thing. So, you know, there's enormous animosity that goes along with presenting this kind of information to an audience that's not an academic audience. You know, an academic can get the nuance of it. But anybody else that is on the other side, you know, and ideologically rigid, tends to interpret this as an assault on Americana and its exceptionalism. You know, so that you know, I'm sure. So anyway, I'd be happy to answer any questions or take any comments, really, if you have any comments and reflections on this whole issue. It's a big one. Yes, sir.
Thank you for the truly wonderful presentation. I think it shows how far we have gone from the early thinking of social status and social life. And you have really contributed immensely to understand all the complexities that go with this phenomenon of migration, and courageously pointed out, you know, what we can collect from wonderful studies of migration and reading and thinking about. One of the comment I want to make is that I think there is confusion in the literature around the word depression. Because I have been studying depression from a slightly different point of view of demoralization, which I have conceptualized as a system of emotional distress that you speak about, and also a sense of incompetence, which eventually, as the stressful situation increases in severity and duration. Some people feel perceive themselves as incompetent, become helpless. Some people are helpless, become hopeless. Some people are hopeless, become suicidal. And this continuum seems to acquire, I think studies have shown that, very good studies, seems to acquire a life of its own, independent of the level of emotional stress. Mm-hmm. So that now hopelessness becomes the problem. And I wonder sometimes if any of these differences.
Yeah. No, that's a wonderful point, and it shows the complexity of what we simplify with these instruments and the kind of work that we do when we try to be so reductionistic and get statistically significant results. Right? I think another place where this is really clear. I mean, when I did diagnostic research on clinical patients, the area that we found for Latinos that was underdiagnosed was bipolar disorder, because they don't have the representative manic characteristics that we're used to seeing. So it's again, because for women, you know, they're not going to go on flights of fancy and have sexual adventures and go, you know, credit card runs and where they run up thousands of dollars if there's these low-income women. That's just not, it's just not in their repertoire. That's not something they're going to do. They're not going to go drinking, you know, and go wild and use drugs and, you know, suddenly and inexplicably, you know. They don't do those behaviors. They don't take those flights of fancy. I remember I explained this to one of my colleagues at the university who's a Mexican-American woman, and her mother came from Mexico, and she says, that helped me understand my mother and why it took so long to diagnose her. You know, when she would take her flights of fancy, she would just eat a lot of chocolate. So I think it shows how you have to encase these things in their cultural interpretation and nuance. That's why I think in Nigeria, I don't think we've measured anything correctly there, you know. I mean, if we went to China and went to all of the areas of China and we went to India and we went to a lot of other countries, I'm not sure what we'd be measuring. And you're talking about even finer grained understanding of depression. And actually, remember, a lot of these disorders are not standstill. They change over time themselves. there's a lot of persistence of things like depression, because we know, I mean, actually Mexican Americans have one of the highest rates, even though they have the low rate of actually having it. If they have it, it's recurrent. It's 50%, you know, recurs, and 50% of people recur with another episode within a year. So it's highly recurrent. But I'm not sure which type of depression we're measuring there, because you're raising some very important issues. People who have cancer, for example, and are going through chemo, are subject to be depressed, right? Now, what kind of depression is that? Is that simply reactive depression, to the situation they're in because they've got cancer? Now, the drugs are inducing, some of this depression. I mean, you're feeling pain everywhere in your body. So all of these are depression. I mean, if you use the PHQ, you're going to get depression, right? So these are all fish, but they're all fish of a different stroke, so we really have to take that into consideration. And it vastly oversimplifies the way we do these measurements. And I'm sure it's nothing but confusing to people in audiences like this one, unless you already know this literature backwards and forwards, how you can use a diagnostic interview schedule and get lifetime rates of 25% for all disorders put together, and how you get 50% when you use a different instrument. And the big difference is simply because Ron Kessler decided, people don't want to take all those diagnostic modules. They'll quit the interview and give up and give you false information. So what we're going to do is fix that by putting the screeners in the front of the interview. So we know they're positives right off the bat for the opening screeners for this, all the rest of what came after that, instead of negating it, because they learn the instrument. And they negate everything else that goes past it because they're sick of spending all this time trying to answer these horrible questions. You should see how they're worded. These questions are horrible. Many of these questions are impossible to understand. They're so arcane in the way they're specified. But bottom line is that, you change an instrument. Maggie Alegria showed this. She split the sample in half nationally, and she placed the health services section in the front of one and in the back of another, right? 30% difference in reporting. So we know these things happen. We don't have any perfect solution to these. It costs so much money to collect data. And it's so difficult to do that we are unfortunately reduced to a blunt instrument in trying to understand these kinds of issues of what is depression. And we keep adding to the pile. I mean, we found explosive depression, for example, it didn't exist previously, and that's okay, a new nuance, which I believe it exists. I've seen it. I think it exists, but it wasn't there before. It was just kind of a side thing, that you stuck onto it. And we have all kinds of, categories, diagnostic categories that it's really difficult to understand exactly, how reliably, even in a clinical setting, these can be diagnosed. Inter-rater reliability between research clinicians, is not that wonderful for a lot of these different diagnostic categories that have a lot of occult, interior types of things like delusions and, who knows when it's a delusion and who knows when it's just an expression of a deep internal feeling that you have, and your mind's just meandering. If you're not from the same cultural background and you don't have a really good linguistic fit, there's going to be a lot of slippage in interpretation, even in the best of circumstances. Yes?
So, yes, thanks a lot. And to talk about the early stages of life, whether it's the adolescents or the young women who are raised to learn that, I'm really interested now what your focus is. What are your questions looking at the older adults?
Well, yeah, of course now I've had to accede the epidemiology thrown to Dr. Markidis, down in Galveston, who's done seven waves on a sample of people who are now 85-year-old survivors, and he's been looking at these things very closely. So I'm now getting into looking at their sustainability, over time, and what makes people sustainable at all levels, what kinds of support, what kinds of financial supports, etc. And I'll tell you what happens with Latinos is that they're healthy. And these migrants that we're talking about are so healthy, they continue to live. But they're actually now, at the end of life, when they move up above 65 years of age, they actually become more susceptible to chronic conditions than do the U.S. born. They continue to live, though. They survive. And they survive into their 80s, a lot of these people. But they survive with these conditions. This, they have this condition. Of course, you're getting older, so you have. And of course, what we've seen in LA, very few people think about this, but the reality is, in the last 10 years, just LA County, 40% reduction in heart disease and death attributable to heart disease, stroke, and heart attack. Okay, 40. If we had about a 30% reduction in death attributable to diabetes, but we had 100% increase in Alzheimer's-related death because people live longer, right? But of course, this is going to kick up, you know, the long-term survivor people who are going to eventually develop Alzheimer's. And we don't really know where the top end is. I mean, I don't think we have any, and that's another thing I've really been looking at now is worldwide estimations of Alzheimer's, because we don't have any national U.S. data that really gives us a firm estimate on that from a survey or something like that. But, you know, we have regional surveys. We have surveys that have come out of areas. But, you know, you hear estimates that are all over the place. I mean, it's everything from the international surveys that have been in Europe and South America, Mexico, and they have rates of 8%. For Alzheimer's diagnosed, and based on population data, right? In the U.S., we talk about rates up to 50%, right? And so, again, it's the same thing as some of these other things, but our case ascertainment methods end up being idiosyncratic and method artifactual. Now, they're idiosyncratic because we being the U.S., will always design our instruments and say our instruments are the best instruments. And then the measurements have artifacts themselves, the way they're constructed. So, you know, we try to tease those out, but, we, you know, when you have a diagnostic instrument it's either positive yes or no, it's categorical, it's very difficult to measure error. It's very difficult because all we have is a lead standard of a clinical diagnosis, and, you know, that isn't very perfect either. So, you know, we have a lot of slippage, but we do the best we can. And I think that's where we are with all of these things until we actually have pure biological markers that we can use to predict, you know, Alzheimer's vulnerability. And we keep thinking we have them, but we haven't gotten there yet. You know, right now we can mostly, we don't know if what we see in brain scans, for example, is a cause or effect of, you know, of the disease itself. So I've been looking a lot at that kind of epidemiology and trying to see how far are we from that and how much is there really of this problem, because the rates, for example, for Mexican Americans that come forward in Alzheimer's and the rates for Puerto Ricans in New York were vastly different. I mean, 100% difference in the rates estimated, much lower for Mexican Americans. Is it real? I don't know if it's real. I think the science has just simply got to get better. I think we need, you know, some biological markers to really establish that. Anything else? I think we still have a few minutes anyway. Any other comments? No? Okay. Well, Ezra? Thank you. Thank you for coming. It was really a pleasure to have this opportunity to talk about these things. I really don't get that many opportunities to talk about these kinds of things anymore. Most of the talks that I'm asked to do are either on aging and policies and things like that, or they're about health disparities. People don't want to hear too much about mental health. They still can't get that the body and the mind are connected, but, you know, it's mostly about health disparities, which I've done a lot of work in the last 10 years around as well.
We're going to work on that in the mental health.
Okay, good. And I want you to know that I have heard public health leaders talking about behavioral health for the first time. Jonathan Fielding in L.A. County, he said, we've got to address this. I just saw him 3 days ago do a talk, and he said, we have to address social determinants of behavioral health problems in Los Angeles. So there's hope at the end of this long, 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 long process. It's slow, but, you know, I think it was Churchill that said, well, Americans do it wrong, 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 and then finally, as a last resort, they get it right. So.
Thank you.